Hi, I'm Marco Werman, host of The World. I am so proud of the work our team has done in the past year. And as we look ahead to the new year, there are many more stories we want to bring you. Stories that focus on the people at the center of global events, helping you make sense of all of it through the noise, giving you the insight and perspective that you rely on with The World. If you've already donated, thank you. Your financial support and messages mean everything to us. We have just a few weeks until our December 31st deadline, and we're still short of our goal. If you have not donated yet, I hope you will today to help us get one step closer. Visit theworld.org/give to put your name on the list of people who support The World. Thank you very much. Today, helping out in hard times, we meet world-renowned chef Jose Andres. He has Michelin-starred restaurants and delivers meals in war-torn Ukraine.
Brings hope, brings dignity, brings a message of telling the people you are not going to walk alone in this difficult hour.
Also, the elders, world leaders who bring their wisdom to the fight against climate change.
It's our collective wisdom that is our strength, I think, and our moral voice. And of course, if you want to have a moral voice, you've got to live it.
Former Irish President Mary Robinson is living it. And the story of a man who refused to leave his bombed-out home in Syria. He stayed with his piano and played in the streets.
With this music, it was kind of good feeling. 5 minutes where the people think about only now we need to sing.
We sang in praise of the helpers today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on this Friday leading into a big holiday weekend. Thank you for being with us. We've got a special edition of the show lined up for you. We're focusing on the people who help out during hard times. You know, there's a lot of stuff we hear in the news that is scary, that makes us feel hopeless maybe. So today our coverage is about flipping that script as we take a cue from none other than Mr. Rogers and a lesson he learned from his mom.
She would say, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers, you know, even just on the sidelines. That's why I think that if news programs could make a conscious effort of showing rescue teams, anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy, to be sure that they include that. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
So we begin today meeting a man who certainly doesn't need to do what he's doing. Spanish chef Jose Andres is celebrated for his culinary innovations and Michelin-starred restaurants. He's also the founder of World Central Kitchen, a nonprofit that makes sure people impacted by natural disasters are eating. World Central Kitchen doesn't normally venture into war zones, but Chef Jose made an exception for Ukraine. He's made at least a half dozen trips there this year. We caught up with Chef Jose on the road after he'd just returned from the war-torn Ukrainian city of Kherson.
People were cooking whatever they had outside in the streets, making fires where everybody will share whatever they had to make a hot meal that will be shared by the community. We came into Kherson with done more than 600,000 meals delivered in the form of food bags, 30 pounds each. And we've been helping install also water distribution systems in different parts of the city.
Is the celebration in Kherson typical of the reception you and World Central Kitchen get when you arrive in a city or a town?
Well, you need to understand, sometimes you're giving a food bag, water and bread to a family that absolutely had nothing. Every single shelf, every single warehouse was totally empty. So you have to imagine that tens of thousands of people want to get the humanitarian aid, but everybody is overall very, very polite. And what happens is that especially what they call here the babushkas, the grandmothers of Ukraine, who are beloved here in Ukraine, they will give you a hug. That people in these situations, not only in Ukraine, but anywhere around the world, what they want sometimes is use dignity. They don't want our pity. They want our respect. And they feel that when we show up quick and fast and we are there next to them, sometimes just giving them a hug or a smile, sometimes these is things that they also need.
I'm guessing you've gotten a lot of hugs, Chef Jose.
I've gotten a lot of hugs, and it's great to give them. And and receive them, especially in these moments. I think everybody will agree that war has no space in the 21st century.
This is World Central Kitchen's first work in a war setting. I know one of your partner's kitchens was destroyed by shelling in Kharkiv in April. How is this mission different from mobilizing kitchens in disaster areas? I mean, there's destruction for sure, but what does the added variable of war mean for you and your team?
Here is where you see that wars should never happen anymore, that war has no space on planet Earth, and that we need to be investing in the betterment of the lives of every single Ukrainian and every single human on planet Earth, not to use money and weapons used to create chaos and mayhem.
I'm speaking with Jose Andres, the chef and founder of the humanitarian World Central Kitchen. Chef Jose, you have Michelin stars at a dozen restaurants. You could be working right now in the grandest kitchens in the world, and yet you're in a war zone. Why?
You know, every one of us, we have a call in certain moments. I had a call more than 30 years ago when I saw that chefs, cooks like me, that we feed the few. We also have the same talent to come and in different ways try to feed the many and transform the problem into the solution. I'm here because, you know, destiny has put me in this path where this organization and other organizations I work with, I volunteer with, we can make a difference. Obviously, bringing food to people doesn't end any problem, but in the short term, brings hope, brings dignity, brings a message of telling the people you are not going to walk alone in this difficult hour.
Yeah, where else is World Central Kitchen right now? How many places around the globe?
Just in this last month, we were back-to-back hurricanes, Ian and Fiona, and we were in, obviously, a part of America in the Caribbean, in Puerto Rico, in Dominican Republic. We were in Canada. We gave aid in Afghanistan after an earthquake and in the floodings in Pakistan.
Right.
You see, we don't come with a plan, but we adapt, and especially we use the local resources and the local infrastructure always to our benefit, to be fast and to be quick, because an emergency can never wait. The urgency of today is yesterday.
Chef Jose, it occurs to me that you straddle two disparate worlds of humanitarian assistance and high dining. I mean, anybody who's seen your appearances alongside the late Anthony Bourdain will know that you embrace gastronomy. It is life. But so is food for survival. I mean, for many people, that also is life. What occurs to you when your thinking goes from disastrous situations where you're helping people to considering where food culture has kind of gone over the top in recent years?
I always like to repeat the words of this food philosopher, Brillat Savarin, that in 1826 said, "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you who you are." Mm-hmm. Food more than ever has become a sign of culture, a sign of understanding who you are. It's almost a way to people and families and entire nations to present themselves, to be proud of who they are. The food they eat, the food they harvest, the food they cook tells a story of who they are, who every one of us is. But this same guy, Brillat Savarin, said that the destiny of the nations will depend on how they feed themselves. So food obviously is culture and pop culture and is celebration and building longer tables and inviting people we know and people we don't even know as a sign of respect, as a sign that you are welcome to my home. And the best way I have to show you respect is with a plate of food. Food is at the heart of everything moves on planet Earth.
So finally, Chef Jose, turning back to Ukraine, where you are, what's on the menu there now? What's available and how is World Central Kitchen working with the local chefs?
Well, you produce the ingredients they have. So you will see things like borscht. The dishes you will see are used traditional ingredients that Ukrainians like, obviously always adapting to what is available. So as you see, even in a city that has been going through a hard time, use a food like a watermelon that is highly celebrated in America in summer, in many ways has been a reason of celebration. The watermelons have been free. Let's all hope that this war will be ending very soon and that next summer, watermelon will be enjoyed by all Ukrainians dreaming of a better tomorrow.
Well, that is a lovely symbol. Thanks for leaving us with that. Chef Jose Andres is the founder of World Central Kitchen. He joined us from the road in Ukraine, where he's traveling between operations, feeding the hungry. Chef, thank you very much for what you do and for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you to all. And never forget Ukraine, please.
It happens more than we realize. Someone like Chef Jose, a stranger who comes out of the blue to lend a hand, it can make all the difference.
I just want to tell this story of someone that touched my heart so much in a way I can't ever forget.
That's Jessie Maseli in Abuja, Nigeria. Her teenage son, Oriva, was accepted to study at a university in Reading, England, some 3,000 miles from home. Jessie dropped him off at school, consumed with worry.
He was just 17, first time being away from home. All the motherly concerns, what was he going to eat? How was he going to cope generally on his own for the first time? When I got to Reading, we settled him into the hostel and then we went to church. And I actually got up, introduced myself and said, look, I was bringing my son for the first time to the UK from Nigeria. And I'm sure from the way I spoke, my concerns must have shown. So after the church service, this wonderful lady just walked up to me, holds my hand in such a comforting manner and says, I'll take care of your son for you. Oh my God.
I think she was a bit surprised because I didn't know her. I haven't met her before. When a mother said, oh, I'm leaving my son behind, I felt sympathetic. I have children as well.
And immediately she introduced herself to my son. I took her number, she took his number, and then I left back to Nigeria.
This was just the first time I'm on my own and didn't really know anyone in Reading because it's a different culture to what I grew up with. I didn't really know British culture.
But I actually made a room for him in my house so that he would feel comfortable.
They would come see me over the weekends and cook for me as well and give me loads of food to stock up and eat during the week. Any day I was free, she would invite me over to hers for a meal or with her kids as well. So yes, she was like my second mother, basically.
I've really enjoyed kindness from other people, people I don't know. And that was the reason I become the mother to the child.
They were really helpful. They were like selfless. They surrendered their weekends to take me around places. And I don't think I got the chance to be lonely because they were always one call away and kept calling me to check up on me to make sure I was fine.
Ruby was taking care of my son and she was also sending, calling me, reassuring me in Nigeria that your son is okay. She was taking care of both him and she was taking care of me.
Grew in wisdom and made very well in his study. And I believe I played my part to support him academically, spiritually, and also reassure the mother that you don't have to be worried.
Even now, every time I go back to Reading, I'm always stopping by to say hi to them just because it's left a long-lasting memory. Where I live now, there's a university. I always go out of my way to help international students who are new to the country, just help them settle and just give them back, basically. But it's just the importance of, I guess, being kind and being your brother's keeper, especially when you didn't have to.
It was such an act of kindness from somebody I've never known before. I've never known Ruby before. And she just walked up to me. I'll call her my angel and took care of my son and allayed all my fears.
That was Jessie Maseli, along with Oriva Ogini and Ruby Aka. They told their story to the world's Joy Hackle. Sound designed by Robin Moore. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Coming up later in this special edition of the show focusing on helpers, we try to understand why we humans are inclined to helping out in ways big and small. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today, the whole show is about meeting people who help out in hard times. Sometimes that can come at a great personal cost and sacrifice, like the story of Eham Akhmut. 8 years ago, during the height of Syria's civil war, photos and videos of Ahmoud playing piano made their way across the globe. You might recall these remarkable images, Ahmoud performing at his piano in a bombed-out street, glimpses of hope and humanity in desperate times. The World's Sarah Birnbaum checked in with Ahmoud recently about his efforts to soothe people through music.
Ahem Ahmoud comes from a family of musicians, and when he performs this song, he always thinks of home.
Yarmouk, ya Yarmouk, Yarmouk, ya Yarmouk, Yarmouk.
Ahmoud was born as a stateless Palestinian in one of the largest refugee camps in the world, a place called Yarmouk on the outskirts of Damascus. Over the years, the camp grew into a bustling district, the capital of Palestinian life in the diaspora. Then came Syria's civil war. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad ordered the bombing of the neighborhood on December 16, 2012, to punish some of the residents who had rebelled against him. Thousands fled, but Ahmoud, who was 24 years old, decided to stay. His family wouldn't be displaced again.
In 1948, my grandfather, he flee first time from Palestine. I don't need to flee again from Syria. This was my idea. I thought this will finish in 5-6 days and we can stay in our home and everything fine.
Instead, at the end of 2013, Syrian forces surrounded Yarmouk camp and cut it off from the rest of the world. It became an open-air prison. No running water, no electricity, no medicine. People were dying of starvation. Civilians pleaded for relief.
Medicine! We need medicine! Where are you, Red Cross?
The BBC sent in a camera crew around that time.
I'm so tired, this woman cries. Another woman stops us, pleading, please, please take us out. We're dying here.
During the crisis, Ahmoud did the only thing he felt he could. He played music. He and a group of guys from the neighborhood pushed his banged up, out-of-tune piano into the streets. They started a singing group, the Yarmouk Guys.
The guy, they was never singing in the life, you know, and they sing like that. And I try to kind of educate them with the music. And they call me teacher, I am, and we begin sing, and suddenly I begin make music course in the street with the singing group.
Their first concert was held at a bomb crater where a middle school once stood. It's where the first rocket hit in 2012. The performances became a regular thing. Ahmoud says in the morning he'd line up for a UN food package, then he'd scavenge for clover and leaves so he could feed his family. In the afternoon, the Yarmouk guys would rehearse. They'd practice whatever song Ahmoud had written the night before. Then they'd push the piano into the street and sing. Ahmoud says the goal was straightforward, to stop everyone from going crazy.
With this music, it was kind of good feeling, let's call it. 5 minutes or 10 minutes where the people think about only now we need to sing.
Some of the songs were funny, some were sad. Kids from the neighborhood would join in. Ahmoud's father, a violinist, also showed up sometimes. Soon, videos of the performances spread online, first in the Arab world and then farther away. Ahmoud says the videos were his personal revolution. He played piano to spite Assad and to counter violence with art.
In this time, the Syrian government was every day telling about those terrorists living in Yarmouk County. And I try to show we have a lot of civilian. We are not fighter. We are not people with weapon. We have only this piano.
Meanwhile, life inside Yarmouk grew more desperate. Radical Islamists were taking over. Playing music on the street became very risky. Ahmad moved his piano into narrow, crowded alleys where snipers couldn't reach him and continued to play. Because, he says, with all the senseless death around him, it was the only thing he had control over.
People die in this time for nothing because they don't have 3 days of food. You know, they die. You know, when you begin think you will die in any way, yeah? You think, no, I should take decision, you know, to die for something.
Then ISIS took the decision out of his hands. In 2015, the jihadist group conquered Yarmouk. Ahmad and his family managed to get to the neighboring settlement, Yalda, but he didn't want to leave his piano behind. So he went back and tried to get it through an ISIS checkpoint. The guards doused it in lighter fluid and lit a match. Soon after, Ahmad escaped from Syria. Today, he's in Hamburg, Germany. He works as a professional musician and gives lessons to children. People all over the world write to Ahmad to tell him how meaningful his performances were, how he's a symbol of hope. Even back in Syria, in the middle of the siege, he remembers meeting with this photographer, a guy named Niraz Sarid. As Sarid was setting up his camera, a woman came up to them. She was carrying a tray. She'd made them coffee, which was a miracle. Ahmad couldn't remember the last time he saw coffee. The woman was using up the last bit she had. She'd been saving it for a special occasion. As she poured Ahmad a cup, she said, "What you're doing is very important." But Ahmad struggles with it. There was a price.
My brother in the secret police, since 10 years, we don't know nothing about him. Niraz Saeed, that photographer, he got killed in 2018 in the secret police. It's cost a lot, that revolution, our revolution with the music. Cost me, cost my friend. You should know a lot of people die for that.
Was it worth it? Ahmad still wonders about that as he continues to play. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum. هذا الخراب كله يا الله يا الله إلى أين وصلنا يا
الله We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Sometimes lending a hand simply means lending an ear, like in a Turkish pub where everybody knows your name.
Everybody knows that there are some people like you here, very similar people, so they feel that I'm not alone.
Finding community in Istanbul where your sad stories are heard, and why we humans are geared toward altruism, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today, it's a special edition of the show looking at people who help out during hard times. Our next guest was the first female president of Ireland. That was in the 1990s. Later, Mary Robinson became the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. In recent years, she's been chair of the Elders, a group founded by Nelson Mandela. Their mandate is simple, but nothing short of enormous. Sharing their accumulated wisdom and experience to help solve the world's toughest problems. Mary Robinson herself is focused on tackling the climate crisis.
Well, we were given a serious mandate by Nelson Mandela, but we were also told to be humble when we went anywhere that was a situation of conflict. First of all, to listen and then try to give whatever experience or wisdom we might have.
On a serious note, though, I mean, in this context, it's not just about being an elder, being old, is it?
Actually, it's our collective wisdom that is our strength, I think, and our moral voice. And of course, if you want to have a moral voice, you've got to live it, which we try to do. So it's not so easy.
And to build on the literal meaning of the elders, what is the advantage of age when it comes to the work that you do?
I think the idea is respect, actually, in many cultures, including, I must say, here in Ireland. We greatly respect elders still. In the United States, people don't like to be thought of as old or elders or elderly. But frankly, I always respected my elders when I was growing up. Only I did it in a different way. I had a grandfather whom I really appreciated greatly because he was a retired lawyer. And that's where I got my inner sense of justice. I think he instilled it in me in a very strong way. But we had an intergenerational conversation that went one way only. Now the elders seek out and really appreciate the intergenerational conversation, which goes two ways, because these young climate activists, young people working on issues, are so informed, so global. They're on social media with people all over the world. They have insights, and we learn as much, and we love being in that dialogue with younger people.
You've said one of your regrets from your time at the UN as High Commissioner for Human Rights is that you did not make any speeches about climate change. How has your own thinking about this massive problem shifted in the past 20 years?
I had a huge mandate of human rights, rights of people with disabilities, gender equality, you name it. And I was aware that climate was very serious, but it wasn't my problem until I started working on the ground in African countries on the rights that matter if you don't have them, rights to food, water, health, education, etc. And the penny dropped very quickly that actually climate change was undermining and exacerbating all of the rights that people were supposed to have and to be able to realize. It was really shocking. And we weren't talking about climate change even then. Mm. You know, in 2003, 2004, 2005, it still wasn't an issue. Now it's become an issue in the Northern Hemisphere. We see, you know, the fires in California, the flooding in Germany, the drought in various parts of Europe. We see it all now. It's a global issue, and we understand better. So we're all evolving in our understanding.
And what you've been hearing as you speak with young climate activist Mary Robinson, many are rightfully angry about the world they've inherited, a world, to be blunt, my generation and yours and many before have passed on to them. It makes me feel guilty to some degree, but that's not helpful either, is it? How do you think about that?
I do think it's right that young climate activists do feel angry, and more that they channel their anger into now and the future. You know, I came out of COP27, where I was on panels with a number of these wonderful climate activists like Vanessa Nakate of Uganda, whom I visited in Uganda before. What really struck me reflecting immediately after the conference was it's a paradox. We actually are on the cusp of a clean energy world, and yet I know, sadly, that we're actually heading for a disastrous world. We're heading for a world of 2.4 degrees warming if every country and every corporation did all that they have now committed to. In other words, fulfilled all their commitments. So we're that far off track. We haven't had the commitments we should have from the big emitters to really bring us down to a world where the limit is 1.5 degrees, which is what the scientists have advised. So it's that mixture. Have we time? We can't just go on the positive side. We've got to cut the emissions, and we've got to restore the biodiversity.
Yeah, and 2.4 degrees Celsius points to a very unpleasant future for a lot of people. Go back to what you were talking about earlier, your family. You mentioned your grandfather. Now you're a grandmother. How have your grandchildren changed your thinking about the future?
I think they ground me in the necessity that we have a livable world, not just for them. I feel it's really important when we think about the future generation and grandchildren that we think about the world they will live in. I want them to live in this wonderful world that's just around the corner. Mm. It's a world we should be imagining more, the clean energy world. Cities will be green with walkways. The air will be sweet. We'll hear the birds singing. And there'll be farms and gardens in cities. And the countryside will be rewilded. It'll be restored with biodiversity. We'll really understand that we are nature. We're not separate from nature. We are nature, which is what the indigenous wisdom tells us. These are big, big goals. We're in a transitional time. In some ways, it's exciting for young people. In some ways, it's acutely frightening. And I know quite a lot of young people are full of anxiety, eco-anxiety, I think they call it.
So, Mary Robinson, today the theme of this edition of our program is helping in hard times. How do you think about what we owe each other as humans on this planet?
Well, I know what Nelson Mandela told us. In tackling difficult issues of peace, human rights, etc., we must bring hope. And I learned also when I was on a panel some years ago with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, we were on a panel in New York called the Global Good Summit. And when Archbishop Tutu is in front of young people, he would throw out his arms and tell them how much he loved them and believed in them. And we had a journalist moderating who said quite sharply, "Archbishop Tutu, why are you such an optimist?" Mm-hmm. And he shook his head and he said, "Oh no, I'm not an optimist. I'm a prisoner of hope." And wow. I remember being so affected by that at the time. And I thought about it a lot since then. If you can tell the climate story with hope, then people get excited and they say, "Oh yes, I can see how it's possible to advocate for that clean world and be angry with those who aren't doing enough."
Well, the picture you gave a moment ago of the future, sweet, clean air, birds chirping, that certainly gives hope. Speaking of hope, I want to ask you a final question, some advice perhaps. In the Northern Hemisphere, as you know well, we experience some of the longest nights of the year. On days when you barely see the sun, Mary Robinson, what keeps you hopeful?
I think it's very much that sense of the real possibility of a much fairer world. You know, I'm going to answer in policy terms. I often do that. We're on the point, I think, of seeing that the international financial system is a bit broken and we have great inequality in our world. You know, when I'm thinking around the fire in the dark in an Irish pre-Christmas, it's very much about, you know, the real potential, how close we are to this world that is sustainable with nature. That is actually much, much better for us and inevitably will be much more equal.
Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland. She is chair of the Elders and founder of the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
The floods that ravaged Pakistan this summer displaced 8 million people from their homes. Many are still living in camps and tent cities, including a lot of pregnant people. Over the past 3 months, an estimated 40,000 women affected by the floods have given birth in these camps. It's often under difficult conditions. The World's Carolyn Beeler has this story of a mother who gave birth at a displaced person's camp in southern Pakistan. That was possible thanks to the help of a neighbor.
After her home was destroyed by the floods, Saiba Jamali and her family moved here to a dust-colored tent surrounded by thousands of identical ones lined up in neat rows. It was in this tent in late September that she went into labor. There was no doctor that I knew of here, she says. I felt very helpless in this situation. She tells me this sitting cross-legged on the same bed where she gave birth. It was her sixth child, and she'd hemorrhaged with all the others. It happened with every delivery, with every child, she says. So Jamali was nervous about giving birth here, in a camp, without electricity or running water, without a midwife or access to blood transfusions. She couldn't afford a ride to the hospital, though. But a woman from the neighborhood was here, and she helped me, she says. That woman is Chaim Hatun, also displaced and living in a nearby tent. Hatun doesn't have medical training, but her now wrinkled hands have helped deliver hundreds of babies over the years. Her faith, she says, teaches her to help every Muslim. The mothers may rely on us because they have no choice, but we always help willingly, she says. Jamali went into labor in the middle of the night. There weren't extra sheets, the right medicine, a needle or thread for stitches. There wasn't even enough light to see properly. We really didn't have anything, Khatun says, but we just had to deliver. It had to be done. The labor was relatively quick, and the baby, a boy, was healthy. When the baby was born, we were all happy, says Khatun. But then Jamali didn't stop bleeding. Hatun tried tilting the bed and applying pressure. She was afraid she'd die. When the bleeding started, it was relentless. It just wouldn't stop, Jamali says. Her voice wavers as she tells me this. Tears are pooled in her eyes. Eventually, a doctor was called and clotting pills prescribed. After daybreak, a blood transfusion was arranged. After 4 or 5 hours, the new mother was finally stabilized, and Khatun sang a traditional song of celebration. Jamali named her new baby Daud. He has big dark eyes that take in everything as he lays in his mom's lap with two siblings cuddled nearby. Jamali still feels weak and sick from labor. There's not enough food here. It's dusty in the camp, and little Daud has developed a chest infection and fever. But Jamali says without the help of Khatun, she can't imagine how she would have delivered him at all. It would have been dangerous, Jamali says. We had no money. If she had turned us down, where would we have gone? We depended on her. In a nearly impossible situation, a neighbor made it possible to give birth safely. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Dadu District, Pakistan.
As we've been hearing, people perform acts of generosity every day, astonishing acts, sometimes at great risk to themselves. Zoom in to a more micro level, small acts of selflessness occur all the time, almost everywhere you look. Giving up a seat to an overburdened mother with kids on a bus, or giving money to people living rough on the street. Our next guest is an expert on why humans developed what seems to be a powerful drive to help each other. Stephanie Preston is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and author of The Altruistic Urge, Why We're Driven to Help Others. In your book, Stephanie, you write about a man named Wesley Autry. Who was he, and why is his story important to this whole discussion of why humans are inclined to help?
Yeah, Wesley Autry is a noted hero. He was a father standing on the side of the train tracks at the subway in New York City with his two kids, and he witnessed a young man have a seizure. And then after the seizure, the man fell into the train tracks, and a train was actually oncoming. And he felt that urge to help, and he leapt in and knew he didn't have enough time to lift the boy out. And he flattened the boy and laid on top of them in between the tracks, and the train went over them both. He sacrificed potentially his very life in front of his own kids to save a complete stranger. But actually, his actions make a lot of sense in the context of our urge to help in very specific situations where a vulnerable person needs immediate help, and we think we can succeed in helping.
Yeah, and that word, we think we can succeed in helping, I mean, that split-second decision that Wesley Autry made suggests no thinking may have happened, that taking that risk was almost automatic. So is there something like an evolutionary basis for altruism? Has helping others actually helped maybe how we humans survive?
I mean, I think our brains evolved neural circuits to be caregivers, you know, to help vulnerable others like our own offspring, our family members, our community members. But also brains are very good at making implicit, very fast kind of motor decisions to know whether or not our acts will help or not in time or not. Most of the time, if you can't swim, you're not going to leap into the river to save a drowning person. But if you feel strong, you will rush into the burning building to carry somebody out, right? So your brain is actually very adept at making those split-second decisions, which are cognitive and thoughtful in a way, but they just happen so immediately, we don't have time to be aware of them.
So if generosity and selflessness is really part of what it means to be human, like on an evolutionary cellular level, are we reminded of that enough? Like philosophically, would it help if more people knew that?
I think people are aware that there's the goodness in everybody, as well as they're aware that there are tragedies around us every day. I think the news media and the social media tends to emphasize the tragedy and the fear, but they're also aware at the same time that, you know, their communities come together to support anybody in real need. For example, if somebody dies in my community, you know, a food train is instantly set up. People want to express that love, but they're not necessarily sure how to do it. And so food is like an ancient way that we can provide care for another individual, even if we aren't sure what to do. We have that instinct, which I think people do observe regularly. They just maybe need a reminder of it.
Well, I'm glad in a way that you turned the lens back on us and the media. I mean, on our show, we do cover some pretty heavy stuff, the climate crisis, wars, staggering inequalities around the globe, just to name a few. When you're reading the news, Stephanie, do you tune your antenna to be on the lookout for those moments of goodness, particularly in harrowing situations, almost maybe as an antidote to what we in the media tend to focus on?
Definitely as a scholar of pro-social behavior, I'm very interested in cases where people are giving. And there's even a lot of research that's coming in the media lately that says it's good for us. It feels good. And it's good for our health even to be giving and to care for others. So I think it's important to notice that because we can even make ourselves feel better about all of this atrocity if we focus our efforts on what can we do to help.
Stephanie Preston is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and author of the book, The Altruistic Urge, Why We're Driven to Help Others. Stephanie, thanks very much for joining us and giving us this background on why we help. It's really fascinating.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Today's show is all about helping out during hard times. And here's one way we all try to do that, just being a good listener. In Turkey, there's a special type of neighborhood cafe bar known as meyhane. They date back to the Byzantine Empire. It's where you go when you've got emotions to express. You can count on the other patrons' support. Aside from serving small dishes with fish and a strong anise-flavored liquor, the meyhane are places where you celebrate the best of times and where you can count on being comforted if you're grieving. The world's Duri Bascaran takes us inside one meyhane in Istanbul.
As you duck inside from the winter chill, the warm air of a meyhane feels like a hug. The smell of fried calamari drifts over from a nearby table as music from old Turkish movies plays. It's just before the dinner rush at Güneşin Sofrası, a meyhane that takes its name from a phrase in Turkish poetry, meaning table of the sun.
But sofra in Turkish is not only the table. Sofra also means the place where the people come together.
Aslı Yeligöz is the proprietor here. At Güneşin Sofrası, she wanted to invoke an old-timey social club where Turkish secularists once gathered to discuss politics late into the night.
Everybody knows that there are some people like you here, very similar people. So they feel that I'm not alone. I'm in the family, I'm between friends.
And when you're sitting between friends, often for hours, and especially after a couple of drinks, emotions run high. It's not unusual for Yeligöz to spot a guest start to cry.
It's very normal. It's very ordinary. If you can see so many people cries or laughs or sings.
If someone tears up, she keeps an eye on them for a few minutes and makes sure their friends are comforting them properly.
Everybody knows that this is a public place, but also you can feel your privacy. Maybe this is meyhane.
Turkish pop culture and classic movies are full of references to meyhanes. In the 1978 film Derbeder, the famous singer Ferdi Tayfur visits a meyhane after the woman he loves marries another man.
Haklısın. Güçlü olacağım. Olmam lazım.
Seni üzgün görsem. You're right, he tells a friend as tears stream down his face. I have to be strong. In film, and often in real life, the meyhane scene serves as a catharsis.
When you go into meyhane, it's like going to a therapist.
Begüm Babuşçu is a clinical psychologist and a self-described meyhane enthusiast. She says that in Turkish culture, it's not common to speak about your problems explicitly or directly. The meyhane lets you ease into difficult conversations.
When you go to meyhanes, you're not expected to drink fast and you're not expected to eat fast. It's actually considered inappropriate. So you drink slowly and you eat slowly. Step by step, you go into deeper topics. You go into deeper emotions.
With the understanding that everything said at the meyhane table is said in confidence. It's these factors, Babuşçu says, that make the meyhane a place where people feel comfortable letting tears fall, especially men.
So it's not shamed, but it's rather listened.
Maybe it's this acceptance that makes people cry. And the raka probably has something to do with it. That's an anise-flavored liqueur that turns milky white when you add an ice cube and a dash of water.
It's all
By 9 p.m., the Güneşin Sofrası Meyhane is packed. Atil Tashpınar sits with a group of old friends, all retired professional basketball players, to share old memories over plates of eggplant salad, white cheese, and fresh fish. A Meyhane isn't fancy, he says. It's warm. You don't have to compete for status or anything.
Biliyorsunuz, sevinçler paylaştıkça artıyor, dertler paylaştıkça azalıyor.
When you're happy in a Meyhane, your joy increases, he says. It's shared. And when you're sad, your sadness is lessened too. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin in Istanbul.
This hour, we've been looking around the world at stories of kindness, about generosity of spirit. We also wanted to hear some of your stories. Over the past few weeks, we've been asking you to share some anecdotes with us, a story about someone who helped you get through a hard time. And you came through with some really inspiring experiences with friends and complete strangers. We wanted to share two that stood out. Here's Federico Muchnik, who listens to the world in Massachusetts.
My story of my helper, the guy who got my back, is a black blind blues musician named Lewis West, who lives in Cambridge, Mass, who has shown a great deal of resilience and stamina and fortitude despite his condition. 72 years old, diabetic, blind, and living in public housing at a time when I needed just some faith and hope for a condition that I was diagnosed with. Lewis came by and showed me what it was to keep on keeping on. And for that, I'm eternally grateful to him. He's a great guy.
Sounds like it, Federico. Thanks for telling us about Lewis. This other story comes to us from listener Pat Lanier in Fort Myers, Florida. She called to tell us about an incident decades ago when she and two friends had car trouble. They were driving home from a concert in New Orleans at 4:30 in the morning.
We were on the Pontchartrain Bridge when the car started losing power. Everything shut down, including the engine. It was dark and foggy, and a very long bridge. I remember being petrified we would get struck by a semi and tossed into the dark and cold waters below. The very first car that passed stopped to pick us up. I was astounded that a complete stranger would pick up this motley crew in the middle of the night. He took us to the nearest garage, who sent a tow truck to retrieve the car, and the gentleman even called his wife from work to check on us. She called the garage to see if we needed sandwiches or anything else. How loving were these gestures to complete strangers. I regret I never got the names of these angels, but they did impress upon me how important kindness and thoughtfulness is, and I've tried to pay it forward. And I guess that is as good a thank you as I could possibly ever extend my rescuers.
Whoever they are, I hope they're listening, Pat. It was and is all about kindness, generosity, gratitude. Stories this hour that remind us that, though it may feel like it sometimes, we are not alone, even in our times of need. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You help us every day by listening. Thank you for that. Have a great weekend and a Merry Christmas. We'll see you back here on Monday. Before we go, I want to remind you that we are nearing the end of our fall fundraiser. We have until December 31st, but we're still short of our goal. We won't get there without your help. Every gift will get us one step closer. Make your donation to support our human-centered reporting today at theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.
From PRX.